The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Nancy Pelosi has a bill aimed at establishing the Democrats as a one-party state. I blow the whistle on it. Finally, lockdowns are ending in the red states and even some blue states. We're trusting people to use freedom responsibly. Also, is Israel alone in the world? This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast. Hope you're enjoying the podcast. Please hit the subscribe button at the bottom, also the notifications button, and share the podcast with people you know. I'm trying to help. You'll help me get the word out.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats have a plan to turn America into a one-party state. Their plan has a legislative name. It's called H.R. 1 or Bill Number 1. And the name itself is kind of telling. You can see how important it is to them. It's like their first priority. Now, the reason it's their first priority is that elections are obviously a critical process to determining who should rule in a democracy. And the Democrats have a scheme to try to make sure that they're ruling all the time, that the opposition in America becomes a kind of token force. Now, this may seem unprecedented, but in American history, we've had periods where one party has completely dominated. The Democrats have had two clear periods of domination from the 1820s, when Andrew Jackson was elected in 1828, I believe, for about 40 years until the Civil War, and then from 1932, FDR, until 1980, when Reagan brought a stop to all that. And the Democrats would like to see an era like that again, where they are firmly, you may say, in the saddle. Now, this H.R. 1 is a terrible bill because of the way in which it tries to rig things, rig the process at every stage. And they've thought of everything. There's a little summary of it. I'll be going into more detail over time as the bill, which has passed the House very narrowly, without Republican support. The Democrats were wholly behind it. The Republicans were wholly against it. And its fate in the Senate is a little more problematic. The Senate, of course, has the powerful tool of the filibuster, not to mention that it's 50-50 in the Senate. So the Democrat, it doesn't look like this bill will survive the Senate. But the Democrats are fanatical about this. They want to overrule the process. They want to end the filibuster. They want to get this through by hook or by crook. And why is it so important to them? Well, here are some of the things that this bill would do. And this is a little summary by Representative Elise Stefanik of New York. She goes, H.R. 1 would use taxpayer money to fund campaigns. So right away, the money injected in the process. Number two, ban voter ID. This is a big one for the Democrats. Ban voter ID. Number three, prevent the removal of ineligible voters from the registration rolls. So in other words, the simple process of cleaning up the rolls. Number four, they're opening a pathway for felons and minors to vote. In fact, I saw Ayanna Pressley the other day talking about letting 16-year-olds vote. Allow 15 days of early voting, which means kind of the end of Election Day. The elections now suddenly become a more amorphous process and one that's very difficult to control to make sure that only eligible voters are voting. Except absentee ballots 10 days after Election Day. Wow. So the processes that were flatly illegal in Pennsylvania, the 3-day extension for voting, now becomes a 10-day extension. And finally, legalize ballot harvesting. Remember, ballot harvesting was the device used in California essentially to swing even Republican districts into the Democratic camp. Last-minute votes found in somebody's Volkswagen. Oh, that tips the election. There we go. Sorry, the Republican who was announced to be the winner is not the winner anymore. So it's almost like they've got a California formula. They've turned California into a one-party state, and now they want to turn America into a one-party state. Now, the first thing I want to say is that, you know, the government normally doesn't function like this. The government normally is very careful to make sure that they identify you correctly. And so if you look at all these government processes, let's take, for example, the IRS. Don't they make sure that taxpayers are properly identified? You've got your proper tax ID number. If you're undergoing an audit, that they've got the right, they ask you for all kinds of information, not just the IRS. Look at all the loans that they've been making for the PPE loans for COVID. If you apply for a PPP loan, you have to submit all kinds of documentation, all kinds of authentication, all kinds of financial records. And this is true throughout the government. If you go in for any kinds of government documents, they check you out, they want your ID, they match one ID against another. We have verifiable procedures throughout this country to make sure that the right people are counted, and if benefits are flowing, they go to the person who deserves it. But not here. Suddenly, when it comes to voting, which is the cornerstone of our democracy, suddenly all these procedures go out the window. And this can't be because the government is so incompetent. No, they're actually pretty competent in other areas. They're pretty competent, for example, in collecting the money you owe them. They're pretty careful when they're giving you any kind of money. But somehow when it comes to who should rule, the Democrats drop all these procedures. Now, what's interesting is they don't say that that's what they're doing. In fact, they act like they are working to correct abuses. Here's a fascinating article in The Atlantic by Ronald Brownstein, one of the sort of absolute bootlickers of the left. And you can kind of count on him to sort of give you the party line. Now, Ron Brownstein understands the stakes. One of his key lines is, no exaggeration to say that future Americans could view the resolution of this struggle as a turning point in the history of U.S. democracy. He's right. It's a turning point. You know why? Because in a sense, what the Democrats are trying to do is end the normal democratic process of accurate counting of authenticated voters. They want to go ultimately to a system in which is stacked in their favor. But that's not what Ron Brownstein says. He says the opposite. To many civil rights advocates and democracy scholars I've spoken with, he says that the federal law is required to overturn state bills, which, quote, constitute the greatest assault on Americans' right to vote since Jim Crow era battles. So basically, here's what's happening. In a lot of the swing states, Republican legislatures are actually moving to correct voter abuse, fraud, irregularities, to, in a sense, you may say, streamline the system and make sure it's accurate. So in Georgia, Texas, Arizona, Iowa, Montana, many places, you have Republican governors, Republican legislatures saying, listen, there were a lot of shenanigans that happened this one time. They happened maybe because of COVID. There were all kinds of circumstances, but we're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. And it is precisely these efforts to clean up the process, to remove the abuses that the Democrats view as a threat. What they want to do is take these abuses, systematize them, and make them, if you will, permanent. So there's a lot riding on this. In a sense, the integrity of elections itself is riding on it. The Democrats know it. The Republicans know it. In the end, I think this is not going to come down to a reasonable argument over what is the best way to count votes in a democracy. You would like it to be an argument about that. But it's like the immigration debate. The immigration debate isn't really about, let's try to figure out that the right people get in, that true humanitarian standards are applied, they're applied even hand. No, it's not about that. It's how the Democrats simply want to get people across the border. They don't care if they're MS-13 or coyotes or whatever, because to them, it's new voters. To them, it's essentially the same thing. Let's try to make sure we have a permanent majority. That's one way to do it. This is another way to do it. HR 1, it's their top priority, because if they can fix the process, then they can make sure that they are permanently in the saddle. I'm really happy that Mike Lindell and MyPillow are a primary sponsor of this podcast. Mike embodies both the entrepreneurial spirit and the bravery, the conservatism, the Christian faith that this podcast really reflects. So I'm thrilled to have him on board. And I love his products, which I use all the time. Debbie and I are, they're all over our home. I want to focus on his Giza Dream bed sheets, which are made with long staple cotton. Mike guarantees, and I guarantee, they'll be the most comfortable sheets you ever own. The first night you sleep on them, you'll really never want to sleep on anything else. These Giza Dream bed sheets are available in a variety of colors, and like all of Mike's products, they come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. So right now, Mike is offering buy one, get one free by calling 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh for a limited time. Buy one, get one free. Call 800-876-0227 or just go to MyPillow.com, but make sure to use promo code Dinesh. I'm really happy to see that lockdowns are starting to collapse in the red states, and not only in the red states. After Ron DeSantis led the way in Florida, we saw a rapid succession. Texas, Mississippi announced, that's it, no more state requirements. And now I see, remarkably, there are a couple of blue states. Massachusetts has opened the doors to indoor dining. Effective March 19th, Connecticut is lifting all capacity limits on restaurants, retail, libraries, personal services, gyms, museums, and so on. This is a very welcome trend. Now, it's not a trend that Joe Biden is happy about, probably advised by that little ogre Fauci. Biden has been making some extravagant statements about this. And in fact, Biden referred to the Texans as Neanderthals, for lifting these regulations. Now, Governor Abbott of Texas was not too happy with this kind of depiction, and he fired back. Listen.
Is one of the people that he was thinking about. Governor, how do you respond to the president's unification message of calling you and other governors a Neanderthal?
Two things, Brian. First, it obviously is not the type of thing that a president should be saying. But second, he kind of said it on the worst day he could have, because the same day he said that, in Texas, the Biden administration was releasing illegal immigrants into our communities who had COVID. The Biden administration was spreading COVID in South Texas yesterday because of their lack of constraint of testing and quarantining.
Now, we should be a little clear about what Texas and these other states are doing, because it may seem that when they lift these requirements on masks and social distancing, it's like no more masks in Texas, no more social distancing in Texas. That's not true. Essentially, what Texas is doing and these other states is trusting citizens to exercise freedom responsibly. First of all, by lifting a statewide requirement, it's still the case that private actors in the state, whether it's restaurants, I just saw that the Kroger restaurant chain in Texas, for example, you still have to wear a mask. There will be banks where you still have to wear a mask. So private institutions, corporations, organizations can impose mask requirements, social distancing requirements. And of course, individuals can wear masks. I wear a mask. Debbie wears a mask. We're careful. We're kind of at the age where we don't want to get COVID. We have no idea what kind of effect that's going to have on us. So the issue here is not choice. It is who exercises the choice. Is the government going to force you, or are you going to be able, and institutions going to be able, to make their own decisions? Now, the basic argument for freedom is that you tell people what you know about something, and not just the information you know, you also disclose the uncertainties, the things that you don't know, and then you let people make decisions. This is how we operate in all phases of life. I mean, do we need laws? Do we have laws telling people, listen, make sure you wear a warm coat in the winter? No. Why? Because people can see, hey, it's cold outside, I better put on my coat. You don't need a law to mandate that. Do we need laws that force people to eat lest they starve to death? No. You don't actually have to do that. Why? Because if you let people know, hey, listen, if you don't eat, you're going to get sick, you're going to get thin, you're going to starve, you're going to die, people are like, oh, wow, you know what? That sounds kind of like a good argument for eating. Do we need laws telling people not to jump off bridges? No, we really don't. Why? Because people kind of know not to do that. So the bottom line here is what we're saying is that people are in a position where they can assess risk. When their own self-interest is involved, as it is here, nobody wants to get sick, nobody wants to be on a ventilator in a hospital, nobody wants to be in a situation where you're helpless and you're... No! So people are going to take prudent measures. Now, of course, there are people on the left who don't believe this. Their operating premise is, no, Dinesh, don't be so optimistic. People are unbelievably stupid. You have to force them. They're just too dumb to follow normal and they're too dumb for liberty. And my question is, really? If they're too dumb for liberty, why do we have a democracy? Isn't the basic premise of democracy in this country that people have enough intelligence, enough prudence, enough judgment to be able to exercise freedom responsibly? The left doesn't think so. In a very creepy way here, I see people like Keith Olbermann and Michael Moore basically saying, you know what, since the Texans have decided to do this, since they've decided to lift the mask requirements, the governor, let's punish the whole state of Texas by denying them the vaccine. This is how these people think. They are so sick, so demented, that their view is that if you do something politically that they don't like, the answer is, let's deprive them of medicine. Now, in any other area, if you said this to Michael Moore, you said, hey, listen, here's a homeless guy, he's exercising his freedom very irresponsibly. Do you want to deny him health care as a result of that, just to teach him a lesson, to show him that he should act more responsible? No, Michael Moore would be appalled. Oh, no, this is an entitlement. People have a right to medicine. So suddenly, these sickos, to use the title of one of Moore's movies, have revealed their true colors and shown the kind of tyrannical impulse on their side. Let's force people. Let's make them do it. If they don't do it, let's deprive them of the vaccine. How different this is from the freedom spirit that says of people, look, there are people who will make bad decisions, but I would rather someone freely make a bad decision than try to control his life. Did you know that a third of Americans regularly suffer from nausea? My wife Debbie had a terrible time flying. She would immediately feel like throwing up when taking off and landing. That is until she discovered a device that took away her nausea, and she's been using it since 2004. That's why I'm actually very excited about our new partner, That Device, Relief Band. By the way, check this out. This is the Relief Band premiere. Relief Band is the number one FDA-cleared anti-nausea wristband that has been clinically proven to quickly relieve and effectively prevent nausea and vomiting associated with motion sickness, anxiety, migraine, hangover, morning sickness, chemotherapy, and so much more. The product is 100% drug-free, non-drowsy, and provides all-natural relief with zero side effects for as long as needed. The technology was originally developed 20 years ago in hospitals to relieve nausea from patients, but now through Relief Band, it's available to you. Relief Band stimulates a nerve in the wrist that travels to the part of the brain that controls nausea. Then it blocks the signal your brain is sending to your stomach, telling you that you are sick. Relief Band is the only over-the-counter wearable device that has been used in hospitals and oncology clinics to treat nausea and vomiting. It's worked for my family, and it can work for you. Right now, Relief Band has an exclusive offer for my listeners. Go to reliefband.com, use promo code Dinesh. You'll get 20% off plus free shipping and no questions asked 30-day money-back guarantee. So head to reliefband.com and use our promo code Dinesh. The Democrats have constructed, with the help of the media, a whole false narrative around the events of January 6th. And it's almost as if every fact that has been coming out ever since about what happened undermines that narrative. And this explains the kind of dodginess of the media and of the left. Turns out the only shot fired on January 6th was fired by Capitol policemen into Ashley Babbitt. The people who arrested, it turns out that this was an unarmed action, an unarmed, quote, coup, an unarmed insurrection, which an unarmed terrorist act, which none of which really makes any kind of sense. Oh, the Trumpsters murdered a police officer. He was hit on the head by a fire extinguisher. This fiction was invented by the New York Times. You'd think they'd have video to prove it, but they never did. But they just rely on their authority with the New York Times if we said it probably happened. But turns out it didn't happen. That's not how Brian Sicknick died. So the bottom line of it is one lie on top of another. And one of the latest episodes, there's a very interesting interview that CBS did. This is CBS and their new show. It's called 60 Minutes Plus, in which the correspondent Laurie Siegel interviewed the shaman guy. Remember the guy with the horns and the animal outfit and the animal suit, all kinds of skins? This character, supposedly the leader of the insurrection, he's the guy who sort of walked right in there. He's the guy who was the most visible on TV. And Laurie Siegel interviewed the shaman guy, this fellow, Jacob Chansley, but also interviewed his mother. And Bo, I have a little snippet from each one, and they're both extremely revealing. So watch this little clip from the interview with Jacob Chansley to get an idea of why he did what he did and try to ask yourself, is this a really dangerous guy? Listen.
Your actions on January 6th were an attack on this country. Do you understand that?
No, they were not, ma'am. My actions were not an attack on this country. That is incorrect. That is inaccurate entirely.
How would you describe them?
My actions personally?
On January 6th.
My actions on January 6th, how would I describe them? Well, I sang a song, and that's a part of shamanism. It's about creating positive vibrations in a sacred chamber. I also stop people from stealing and vandalizing that sacred space, the Senate. Okay, I actually stopped somebody from stealing muffins out of the break room. I also said a prayer in that sacred chamber because it was my intention to bring divinity and to bring God back into the Senate.
All right, so what in true justice should this guy get for what he did? He clearly was trespassing. He shouldn't have been in there. He's been, by the way, locked up ever since they arrested him. They won't let him out. They won't give him bail. And he's facing multiple charges with years, if not decades, in prison. They're treating him basically like a Bin Laden, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Timothy McVeigh type of guy. But anyone with eyes to see can see he's not that type of a guy. He's a kook. All right. I get it. Even more revealing and to me tragic is the interview that Laurie Siegel did with his mom. In which his mom is just getting a grip on the reality of the situation. Listen.
Do you see anything wrong with what your son did?
What do you mean by wrong? What, like, wrong? He didn't, he went through open doors. He was escorted into the Senate. So I don't know what's wrong with that.
This was an attack on the U.S. Capitol, and your son was a part of it, whether or not you say he was violent. Do you see the gravity of it?
Of course. Of course. I feel the gravity of it because my son is in, you know, he's where he is right now.
Wow. I mean, I feel for this woman. I mean, she knows that her son is out there a little bit. She knows that he's a drama queen, if I can use that phrase. In fact, Jacob Chansley is formerly an actor. And he probably thought he was kind of, you know, doing a routine right out of the Broadway musical Hamilton. And of course, he's got these shamanistic beliefs. But this is not a terrorist. This is not Bin Laden. This is not somebody who deserves to be locked up for years or decades. So I just hate the left's narrative here. I hate what they're doing to people who are defenseless against this onslaught. I hate what they're doing to ordinary people who might be a little bit out there. But any country that treats people like this, I think, has something very wrong with its system. So all this rhetoric of insurrection and riot and terrorism is used to demonize people who don't fit those descriptions, who didn't harm anyone, in many cases who were not even involved in a fight, who came unarmed and came only to, in his case, sing or make a protest. That's all they did. And I'm not saying they shouldn't be held responsible at all. Even kooks are responsible for their actions. But justice is about proportionality, about giving people penalties in measure of what they actually did. I'm afraid that's not going to happen in this case, and I feel very sorry, not just for Jacob Chansley, but for his mom, who will have to suffer through it. I love endorsing products that I use. And normally, advertisers will come to us and show us their products. But in this case, I want to talk about a product that we were using long before. In fact, we approached them. We went to the folks at Antoinette's Bathhouse and invited them to advertise on this podcast so we could introduce you to them. Debbie and I buy, use, we love Antoinette's Bathhouse products and think you will enjoy them as well. Life can be a little stressful. There's nothing like a good soak in the bathtub or an amazing shower to relieve your tensions and relax. The creator of Antoinette's Bathhouse was inspired by the French queen, Marie Antoinette, who loved to indulge in bath time rituals with special concoctions made by her personal perfumer. She endured some pretty heavy criticism and was accused of being wasteful and extravagant. The bath artists at Antoinette's Bathhouse promise you will not create a social uprising for using their wonderful products. The beautiful olive and coconut oil-based soaps, the bath fizzles, the sugar scrubs, the shower steamers, and more are all created with high-quality ingredients. They are lovingly handmade in small batches in the USA. Please check them out at antoinettesbathhouse.com. Let me just show you a couple of the products that they have. This is one of my favorites. This beautiful bar of soap has kind of a rose aroma to it. And all these soaps, I just brought a few to show you. I mean, they're like little works of art. Just check them out. They're extremely cool. This one essentially has the look and feel and aroma of ocean breeze. It's just fantastic. So this is Antoinette's Bathhouse. Go to antoinettesbathhouse.com. It's my favorite bathhouse. Make it yours. Many years ago, I saw the movie with Jimmy Stewart, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Great movie about just an honest, straight-laced guy who makes his way to Washington, D.C. and discovers, well, I'll let you see the movie for yourself. But it turns out I'm friends with a straight-laced guy, a very nice guy. Debbie has actually known Troy Nels and his wife Jill for many years. I've become friends with them over the last few years. And Troy Nels is a newly elected Republican congressman. He was a military guy. He was a captain in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was also the sheriff in Fort Bend County in Texas. Welcome, Troy Nels. Great to have you on the program. By the way, I noticed the glasses, which are giving you a look of tremendous gravitas. Let me start by asking you, you are a red congressman in a district that has now trended blue. How would you say you pulled off your election? What do you think was the key to your success? We're now talking about getting elected.
Well, thank you, Dinesh. And the glasses come with age, obviously. But thank you. It's an honor and a privilege to be here with you and your listeners and followers. Interesting. Yes, Congressional District 22 is Southwest Houston. Many of the Democrats, Dinesh, had this thing as a toss-up race. And so an enormous amount of money was being flooded into this district from Nancy Pelosi to everybody else, the liberals. But we were able to win this thing by 7 points because you ran up against a sheriff. I was one tough sheriff. So we did very, very well, won by 28,000 votes. So they may consider this a toss up here, but I was able to just be very successful in this election because of the fact that I was a former county sheriff and everybody loves the sheriff.
And you are also a no-nonsense sheriff. If I can just mention one little episode, there was a guy who was parading around town with a bumper sticker, essentially using the F word with Trump. And you basically stopped that guy and you discovered he had some violations and you got into some controversy because you took a stand. So it seems to me like you are a nice guy and a well-liked guy, but you're also a guy who's willing to, who doesn't put up with a lot of nonsense when you come across it.
Absolutely. It's just about common sense. And how about some decency when you travel around our county roadways and you have stickers that have the middle finger up and use the F word and for everyone to see. And many people in the county called me and said, there's a truck that's traveling around and my kids are looking at that word from, you know, looking through their windshield, and they say, is that right? Should people display those types of offensive? So I just had a conversation with that individual, and it just turned out to be a very difficult time, not only for me, because people thought I was trying to infringe on their First Amendment, and that was not the case. But yeah, that individual barked up the wrong tree, because we found out that that individual had felony warrants, and so was arrested. But it's just what happened just with common decency today and mutual respect for each other. It just doesn't seem to exist.
Now, Troy, I assume that being a congressman, you've discovered, you probably already knew, is quite different than being a sheriff. And when you're a sheriff, you're running the sheriff's office, and you've got people who are sort of at your beck and call, and you're administering the system of justice in the county. Now, you are one of 430 or so, roughly, congressmen. You're also a congressman in the minority, in the Republican minority. It's not a large minority. It's a razor thin. But nevertheless, so what has been your experience in arriving in Washington, D.C.? People talk about the swamp. Is it a swamp? And give us an early picture of it.
It's a swamp. You know, when I was the sheriff, I had 826 employees, Dinesh, and I was in charge. I mean, I made decisions on a daily basis. Life, I mean, just very, very important decisions. And so when you get up here in the minority, obviously, I consider myself, I'm the little junior woodchuck. I'm the freshman trying to navigate these treacherous waters up here. So, and of course, then we have leadership. So I realize that, can I come up here and change the world in the first 60 days? Absolutely not. But I take it in stride. Some have said, Troy, why do you want to take a demotion? You left the sheriff's office to go to Washington. It's an opportunity. I mean, I feel I have an opportunity to do great things for the congressional district. But I realize that there is a very, very, there's a process up here in order to get things done. And it's a difficult process, especially if you're in the minority.
I remember thinking back to the Reagan years, kind of an amusing anecdote where Reagan called up, this was Howard Baker. He was calling to offer him a position as chief of staff. And he called the Baker residence, but he got Howard Baker's wife, Joy. And so Reagan goes, Joy, where is Howard? And Joy goes, Mr. President, Howard is at the zoo. And Reagan goes, wait till he sees the zoo I have in mind for him. Now, Washington, D.C. has been for a while a zoo, but I've noticed that in recent weeks, it's also become kind of an armed camp. It doesn't look like the capital of a free country. It almost has this kind of militarized presence in Washington. My question to you is, do you think all of that is necessary? And do you think that there's going to be a point soon when all of the military infrastructure comes down?
No, absolutely not. And I think what you're going to see is yesterday, we were supposed to be on the House floor voting on yesterday, but obviously Nancy Pelosi canceled those and snuck in another vote late Wednesday night. So, and she justified it by saying there's some type of a security threat yesterday. I didn't see any type of threat. Of course, every time I walk into my office building, which is Longworth, we have to go through security, and you'll see Capitol Hill Police, National Guard soldiers, the big tall fence with concertina wire around it. I think it's overkill. I've never really felt personally threatened up here, but I think it's just the game they're playing. And now they want to extend the National Guard for another 30 days, which I think is absolutely ridiculous. It's more difficult, Dinesh, to get in here into my office than it is to enter this country on our southern border.
This is really scary. And I maybe ask you a last question, and that is there's been an attempt I see in the media and from Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats to portray what happened in January 6th. Now, I don't condone what happened on January 6th for a minute, but the idea that this was the Oklahoma City bombing, this was 9/11, it seems to me this kind of incendiary rhetoric has very bad consequences, because what it means is that the FBI treats a guy who's trespassing or a guy who walks into the Capitol but doesn't harm anybody as being a domestic terrorist who needs to have their life destroyed and put away for years. Are you concerned about, let's call it, the false moral equivalence that seems to be underway in the approach to January 6th?
it was quite clear for month after month, or at least week after week, month after month, what we saw in the summertime taking across our country, whether it was in Baltimore, Seattle, Washington, D.C., with the rioting. There wasn't a whole lot of talk about that from the Democrats, about burning buildings. And so, yes, what did take place on January 6th was uncalled for. I even said it was un-American. And I can speak on this topic because I was on the House floor. I was there defending the doors leading into the House chamber by individuals that breached our Capitol. And yes, they were rioters. I spoke to the president about this afterward, and he asked me about the individuals on the other side of the door. And I said, I don't know who they were. I didn't ask them whether they could have been Antifa, BLM, some extremist group. All I do know, Dinesh, is those individuals that entered our Capitol, they were very, very angry. I think they felt that their rights were taken. Their voices weren't being heard. It was a sad day, though, in the history of America to see what took place on January 6th. And I hope we can heal. I do. But it just seems like the Democrats are going to continue to try to paint many of these people, the 74,000 people that voted for Trump, as extremists. It's not true. It's not fair. It's uncalled for.
Troy, we're delighted to have you in Washington. I just hope that you don't lose that combination of idealism and practicality that's made you so successful in Fort Bend. I wish you all the best, and I hope we can have you back in the program.
Thank you. God bless you. God bless that beautiful bride of yours, Debbie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dinesh.
I want to talk to you about MyPillow and how it has changed Debbie's sleeping habits. She's going through that sort of change of life, and so she tried all these different pillows, and really nothing worked until she discovered MyPillow. Once she started sleeping on Mike Lindell's MyPillow, she began sleeping right through the night. She also has one of these large body pillows that she loves. The cool thing is that these pillows don't go flat. You can wash and dry them as often as you want, and they maintain their shape. They're made in the USA. For a limited time, Mike Lindell, the CEO of MyPillow, is offering the premium MyPillows for his lowest price ever. You can get the queen size premium MyPillow for $29.98. It's normally $69.98. That's a $40 savings. The king pillows are only $5 more. All these products come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee. Go to MyPillow.com and use the promo code Dinesh. You'll get steep discounts up to 66% on all MyPillow products, including the Giza Dream bed sheets, the MyPillow mattress topper, and MyPillow towel sets. Call 800-876-0227 or just go to MyPillow.com. Make sure to use promo code Dinesh. Is Israel all alone in the world? It's a little bit of a terrifying thought. A small country, a democratic country, a Jewish homeland that was established really in the aftermath of the Holocaust. A country that is surrounded by many deadly enemies, surrounded by people who are chanting debt to Israel, that have launched multiple wars against Israel. And the fact that Israel is even still there has been something of a miracle of modern times. Now, it's very clear that ever since 1948, Israel has had one reliable friend. It had more than one in the beginning. In fact, it was Britain that played a critical role in the establishment of the State of Israel. But the one reliable friend over the past half century or more has been the United States. But that is changing. It started changing dramatically under Obama, who essentially made it very clear his hostility to Netanyahu and to the State of Israel. Obama was, of course, driven by this manic anti-colonialism. He was on the side of the Palestinians. The basic rule with Obama was really simple. If it benefited the United States, he was against it. If it hurt the United States, he was for it. And if you look at the Middle East, you can see perfect corroboration. Who's our deadly enemy in the region? Iran. Obama, of course, makes the Iran deal with Iran. He gives them all kinds of money, sends suitcases of cash. Who are our friends in the region? Well, we had Egypt, and so Obama's like, let's overthrow the ruler of Egypt, Mubarak. Let's support the Arab Spring so we can get some enemies of America in there, the Muslim Brotherhood perhaps, and he did with Morsi. Fortunately, the military stepped in and pushed Morsi out. So this is Obama. This is what he does. And Israel to him was a country to be undermined at every stage. And Netanyahu knew that. And the reason Netanyahu resisted Obama was because he recognized that Obama's hatred wasn't just for Netanyahu. It was for the state of Israel. Now, that is being continued by Biden, who began his term really by calling all kinds of leaders. Sometimes he put Kamala on the phone because, you know, he was taking an early nap. But he abstained from calling Netanyahu to send him a message. Listen, buddy, you know, we're going to be calling the shots. You're going to be at our beck and call, and don't think you can be pushing us around. So ordinarily, I would be a little bit apprehensive for the fate of Israel, with no friends if it doesn't have the United States. But the good news is that Israel has been saved, I think, by Trump. This may seem like an odd thing to say, but the truth of it is Trump did what could almost be called the diplomatically impossible. He brought together Arab countries into deals with Israel. And those deals, by the way, outlived Trump. So even though Trump is gone, the deal with the UAE, the deal with Bahrain, the relationships with Jordan and Kuwait and the Gulf kingdoms and even Saudi Arabia, a critically important country in the region, Trump brokered those deals. Many other people, like you, there's that clip I've played before on this podcast of John Kerry. Oh, there's no way any of these deals can be done without the Palestinians. He just says this with this kind of avuncular sense of superiority. Trump proved people like that to be the buffoons that they truly are. Trump is like, you say it can't be done? Okay, here I am. I have no experience in politics. Let me dust off my hands. There, it's done. There, it's done again. There, it's done a third time. So Trump actually embarrassed these people by doing it again and again. But the long-term benefit of it is that even after Trump is gone, Netanyahu can still make a phone call to the UAE, and he can make a phone call to the Saudis. So the bottom line of it is Netanyahu is not as isolated as he was before. Israel isn't as isolated as it was before. Israel now has real allies, Muslim allies, if you can believe it, in the region. These are allies who recognize that they have less to fear from Israel and more to fear from an irredentist Iran. Iran, too, is building its set of allies, regimes like Qatar, which are doing Iran's bidding in the region. Iran is making friends abroad, as in Venezuela. So there's essentially a divide in the Muslim world now, but one part of that Muslim world, which wants democracy, which wants freedom, which supports the United States, also supports Israel. Biden may do what he can to undermine Israel, but Israel does have some new friends in the region, and those friends, in the end, I think, will be important to protecting Israel's security. Do you think there's a coincidence between Biden signing over 40 executive orders in his first couple of weeks of office and the price of silver skyrocketing? No, there's no coincidence. Savvy investors know that precious metals are a hedge against inflation and government stupidity. And Birch Gold Group is not only your headquarters for gold, but silver too. If you want to purchase physical gold or silver drop shipped straight to your door, or help converting an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver, Birch Gold Group is your solution. They are the premier precious metals IRA company in America, with an A+ Better Business Bureau rating, countless 5-star reviews, and thousands of satisfied customers. And guess what? I'm one of them. There's a tidal wave of inflation coming. Gold and silver are your hedge. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on a precious metals IRA, or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. Time is running out, but you can protect your savings. Text Dinesh to 484848. From Jussie Smollett to Bubba Wallace to Kamala Harris and Rachel Dolezal, we live in a time of, you may almost call it, ethnic fakery. And what I mean by this is people who orchestrate or choreograph racial incidents to make them into victims, or people who suppress their family lineage. Oh, I'm the first black woman descended from slaves. No, you're actually the first woman descended from a Jamaican slave owner who owned 5 plantations. So that's the Kamala Harris deception. In every case, you notice a kind of rigging of the credentials, a rigging of the story, in order to fit a victimization narrative. Victimization is sort of the name of the game And victimization wins you points. That's actually what got Kamala Harris on the ticket. Fake victimization. Now, all of this has a kind of history, a genealogy, you may say, of fakery. And I want to talk a little bit about the original Jussie Smollett, the original Kamala Harris, the original faker. Her name is Rigoberta Menchú. Rigoberta Menchú. She's a Guatemalan woman of really, I would say, no significance at all. But suddenly out of nowhere, her book, I, Rigoberta Menchú, kind of her story, was being assigned, I noticed, in the early 90s, in campuses, curriculums all over the country. I was like, wow, I've never heard of this book. Where suddenly we're reading like Joseph Conrad and Jane Austen and I, Rigoberta Menchú. And I'm like, this is fascinating. And then I noticed in 1992, which was the anniversary of the Columbus landing, that Rigoberta Menchú gets the Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize. And I'm thinking, wow. I mean, I sort of got it a little bit. I thought, you know, the Nobel Committee kind of, they wanted to make a statement about Columbus, anti-Columbus. They kind of wanted to give the prize to some sort of a native person. And then maybe, you know, maybe the actress who played Mulan in the Disney movie was unavailable. In any case, they grab a hold of this Guatemala. They go, let's give it to Rigoberta Menchú. After all, she wrote a book. That's pretty impressive right there. So this was a case of the, you know, the wacky Norwegians or the wacky Swedes doing what they do sometimes with the Nobel Prize, which is they essentially make it into a kind of a joke. Now, I, Rigoberta Menchú is a book that is worth reading, not because of its intrinsic merit, but worth reading for what Rigoberta kind of cunningly does in the book, which is sort of the original Jussie Smollett, Kamala Harris fakery move. Somehow I noticed that the book is a story of sort of victimization. All these kinds of horrors of victimization are described. It's a tale of woe. And the cleverness of Rigoberta is that while some people may claim to be one type of a victim, others may claim to be two types of a victim, so-called twofers. You can also have a triple victim who's, a threefer. Well, Rigoberta is a fourfer. She's a quadruple victim of oppression. Why? First, Rigoberta says, I'm a person of color and therefore a victim of racism. And she goes on to elaborate on this. Then she goes, I'm a woman and I'm a victim of sexism on top of the racism. Then she says, I am of Guatemalan or South American descent, so I'm a victim of North American colonialism. That's brownie point number three. And finally, I am of Indian extraction, she says, and therefore oppressed by the Ladinos or the mixed race Guatemalans inside of Guatemala. So what you can say here is that Rigoberta has grabbed the bottom rung of the ladder. That's her credential. Other people may be oppressed one way or two ways. I'm oppressed sort of every which way. Now, when I first read the story, I felt a little bit bad for her because I thought, you know, here's somebody who does seem to have had all these incidents that have occurred. She talks about these bruising racist battles that she has to fight in ordinary life. Very interestingly, though, a few years later, an anthropologist named David Stoll from Stanford, given Rigoberta's worldwide fame, the Nobel Prize and all, he decided to mosey down to Guatemala and check out Rigoberta's story. And this is guys on the left. He wasn't looking to do anything except check it out. He goes down there and he discovers that pretty much everything that the woman said is a complete lie. So, for example, she presents as a kind of dramatic racist struggle, this fight with her neighbors, whereas in fact, she was trying to take her neighbor's land. It was a land dispute between her and the neighbors that had nothing to do with race, but she had very cunningly racialized it for full benefit. She knew that there were gullible and idiotic Americans and people in the West who wanted this kind of victimization story, and so Rigoberta obligingly supplied one and rose to worldwide fame on the basis of it. Now, of course, when David Stoll blew the whistle on Rigoberta, and he did it in a very cautious, qualified way, he goes, say such things like, I'm not sure she's lying, maybe her memory has been tainted over the years, and so on. He did everything to kind of cover for her, and yet he was bashed by the left mercilessly. Why? Because essentially what he did is he outed Rigoberta Florida. He told the truth. He blew the whistle and said, listen, this woman is not a real victim. She's only a victim in your imagination. She's playing the victim role. She's ultimately doing a certain kind of verbal theater. In the end of the day, even to this day, a lot of this is about theater. It's about showboating. It's about pretending to be something you're not. That was basically the Rachel Dolezal move. I'll claim the advantages of being black by pretending to be black, even though I'm manifestly white. The bottom line of it is we need to be very distrustful of these narratives. Many of them are manufactured by or for the left. And if we see them all around us now, the original faker, Rigoberta Menchú, should at least be known so she can come forward and take a bow. Cybercrime is up 75%, and by far the most serious cybercrime to worry about is home title theft. The job of the criminals is easier than you think. The title documents to our homes are now online. The thief finds your home's title and forges your signature on a quitclaim deed stating you sold your home to him. Then he takes out loans on your home and leaves you in debt. You won't know until late payment or eviction notices arrive. Insurance doesn't cover you, and neither do common identity theft programs. That's why I protect my home with Home Title Lock. The instant Home Title Lock detects someone tampering with my home's title. They help shut it down. Go to HomeTitleLock.com and register your address to see if you're already a victim. Then use code RADIO to receive 30 free days of protection. That's code RADIO at HomeTitleLock.com, HomeTitleLock.com. Is heaven a fairy story? I just saw an article. This is in a British publication, The Express, in London, I believe, UK. And it's titled, Life After Death. Physicist Stephen Hawking rejected the afterlife in scathing attack as a, quote, fairy story. Now, of course, Stephen Hawking died a couple of years ago, March 2018. And he was one of the preeminent physicists of our time, and author of an important book, A Brief History of Time, that was an international bestseller. Interestingly, in this interview that apparently he gave earlier, but it's just come out, Hawking talks about the fact that he really can't believe in the concept of an afterlife. Now, he doesn't really invoke directly scientific evidence, but he says that it's obvious to him that it is, quote, a fairy story. And he implies that it's the product of, quote, wishful thinking. Now, this is what I want to examine a little more closely, because Hawking here is not alone. In fact, it was Sigmund Freud almost, I think over a century ago now, who had made the argument that belief in an afterlife, belief in heaven in particular, and belief in God is, quote, wishful thinking. Freud wrote a book about religion called The Future of an Illusion. And Freud made the argument that we have a human desire to believe that things will come out all right. We have a desire to hope out of expectation that there will be a wonderful future waiting for us. And so we invent this imaginary God and we invent this imaginary heaven to meet this human down-to-earth desire for what Freud defines as wish fulfillment. This has happened to me more than once, but in one of my debates with Christopher Hitchens, this exact issue came up, and he basically made the point that heaven is adult Disneyland. He goes, oh, you've got all these imaginary wonders. And he goes, that's why you Christians believe this stuff, because it's kind of comforting to think that death is not the end, it's not extinction, that you've got this kind of marvelous, amazing thing waiting for you. And so this is an attempt to sort of give an account for, it's not an attempt to refute heaven, but it's an attempt to account for it by giving a kind of practical or human explanation for why believers might make something like that up. Now, I want to say why I think that this argument really doesn't work. It is true that heaven is kind of the marvelous place where no bad things happen. And so if life is difficult and you have hardship, you have suffering, you have sickness, you have death, you have diabetes, arguably such a person might be inclined to make up heaven. Why? Because in heaven you have no sickness, no suffering, no death, no diabetes. But Here's my point. Christianity and certainly the Abrahamic religions aren't just about heaven. If they just made that one up, your argument might work. But Christianity and Islam and Judaism also have another idea. It's called hell. And by the way, hell is a lot worse than sickness, and it's a lot worse than suffering, and it's a lot worse than death. It's a lot worse than diabetes. So my question is this. If believers were essentially people who want adult Disneyland, why would you make up the concept of hell? Where'd that one come from? That clearly didn't come from wish fulfillment. None of us wishes to be in hell. So the very fact that you've got a, almost say, a cosmological scheme on the part of the believer that includes heaven and hell, in which you're morally accountable and you can end up in one place or the other, totally destroys the idea that this is purely some sort of adult Disneyland. The bottom line of it is, you can believe or you cannot believe, but you can't write off believers as if they are merely people who are engaging in some kind of childish wish fulfillment, because their religious beliefs alone, just taken for what they actually are, don't fit that definition. Got problems with the IRS? I got to tell you about a time not so long ago when the big bad U.S. government tried to make an example out of me. And I know firsthand the importance of having proper representation to protect your freedom as well as your finances from being taken by the IRS. Ryan, Danica, and the Christian folks at South Coast Tax will discuss your unique situation and create a tailored framework for how to attack the situation head-on with the IRS and allow you a true fresh start. South Coast Tax has a settlement average of 3 cents on the dollar or 97% reduction rate, along with an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. With 20 years of experience, Ryan told me he has yet to see a tax situation that has stumped him. That's pretty impressive considering the size of the tax laws. Call Ryan at 800-TAX-3156 or check out their website, southcoasttaxresolution.com, and you will see for yourself it will be the best move you ever made in the first step in getting your financial freedom back. That's 800-TAX-3156. It's mailbox time, and we have a very interesting question about neoconservatism. Listen.
Hi, Dinesh. My name is Christian. I was wondering if you could define neoconservatism to me and whether or not you think Trump is a neoconservative. As a young person, I don't entirely understand this term since I've grown up in the era of Trump. Thank you.
Very good question and very interesting question. I know a lot about the neoconservatives. There were a bunch of neocons, as we called them in those days, in the Reagan White House with me. The American Enterprise Institute was largely a neoconservative outfit, the Hoover Institution also to a large degree. Now, originally, the original neoconservatives were mostly Jews who were Democrats, but were Democrats who were worried about the Democrats going soft on Israel and going soft in foreign policy. So they were pro-Israel. They were also vehemently anti-communist. And they began to move over into the Republican side, mainly on the defense issue. Now, on the welfare state, the neocons were not libertarians. They accepted the welfare state. Many of them were for the welfare state to a degree, but they felt the welfare state had become too large, too bloated, too inefficient. And they had magazines like The Public Interest, which had very trenchant and effective, convincing critiques of the welfare state. On social issues, the neoconservatives also were moderate. Many of them were pro-choice, but they were not radically pro-choice. They would defend abortion, for example, under limited circumstances. And some of them, like Irving Kristol, although Jewish, were very favorable to Christianity. In fact, defended the rights of Christians in the public square. Who were the neoconservatives? I would say Irving Kristol was the leader of them. And in fact, he has a wonderful book. It's a collection of essays. It's just called Neoconservatism. And if you want the best of the neoconservative philosophy, it's right here in this book. I just want to read a line or two from it to give you a feeling of Irving Kristol. He's talking about the Victorians. And by the way, his wife, Gertrude Himmelfarb, was an expert on the Victorian era. Irving Kristol is answering the feminists who are deriding this idea that in the Victorian era, and they say this even today, don't put women on a pedestal. And here's Irving Kristol. He goes, living on a pedestal can be a life sentence that real women can find intolerable. On the other hand, it does have its advantages over living in the gutter, which is where most women struggled to live prior to the Victorian era. What the Victorians did, Crystal continues, was extend the category of lady so that all women could potentially enter it, and so that all middle-class and lower-middle-class women were in fact automatically enrolled. And then he goes on to say, so indeed was the parallel notion that you didn't have to be born a gentleman to be one. You could become one by education and self-improvement. And one of the marks of a gentleman is someone who treats ladies with respect. This is classic Irving Kristol in a kind of genial but eloquent and quietly deep style. He is countering an argument from, in this case, the feminist left. Norman Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, his wife Midge Dechter, these were two more of the leading neoconservatives. So I would say neoconservatism today is largely obsolete. We don't have Irving Kristol. We just have his renegade son, Bill Kristol, who is, let's just say, no Irving. And this is true of many of the neocons. Their kids are running around and they're sort of doing their little things, but that era is gone. Many of the best of the neocons were heroes and heroines of mine, and I miss them to this day.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.